As your this conference, recognizing the need to protect our ecological environment and has you the concept of the world with its conquest, the world wildlife and other bodies involved as a result of our plan. Ask the Prime Minister of Norway.
Give us your name, would you?
My name is Dr. Kathleen Shea Abrams, and I'm from Miami, Florida, and I'm Associate Director of a Applied Public Policy Research Center called the Joint Center for Environmental and Urban Problems. I have heard of the concept, not in as much detail as here today. The issues, perhaps concerns that I have relate to, I would say one of the questions that was asked by a speaker this morning, which is that in addressing wilderness conservation and sustainable development, we seem to be asking the right biological questions, but we don't seem to be asking the right social, political, and economic questions. And my concern relates to how we can assure, with the establishment of this bank, that in effect the programs, the projects that are funded actually work and provide a return on the investment based on a sound design of the project, not just a sound biological design, but a design that assures that the project sticks in the country and encourages then future investment. This is, I think, always an issue when one gets involved in a social agenda. In this sense, we're getting involved in an ecological agenda. And so what I'm asking is, what would be the mechanism for balancing the investment return agenda with the environmental agenda in such a way that the social, political, and economic context of those programs is folded in to the investment decisions?
Thank you. It's a very good question. I don't see this vehicle, however it should, however it should be formulated, should try and reinvent the world or reinvent a whole range of new criteria or frameworks within which to operate. We do have some very good, some well thought out frameworks already. And one that comes to mind immediately is the World Conservation Strategy and the National Conservation Strategy process. Now, I know not everybody is particularly enamored with that. I know some people have problems with it. And maybe it still is early days. But nonetheless, that process provides for an individual country to develop in that country through its government and people process national conservation strategies, which involve dialogue with all the components that you mentioned in your question. And that country, and some are already being prepared, Zambia is one, for instance, where the different components of that country's social, economic, and political structures are all woven into the strategy. And that strategy, in turn, is incorporated into the development strategy of the country. Now, what's happened up to now is that funds have been found, or some funds have been found to sort of fund these plans, if you like. But it's very difficult to get money to fund the ongoing investment, because those funds, those plans, if you like, are competing with hospitals and urbanization schemes and so on, because the conventional channels of funds are going into, or tending to go into, conventional investments, conventional projects. Now, I feel that if this new vehicle could be formulated, and formulated with sufficient clout and the right credibility and the right access to the right people and funds and expertise and so on, what it would do would be to perhaps develop the National Conservation Strategy process and maybe other planning processes that exist in countries, and work with that country and through that country. So you're not sort of having to make your own judgment here as to what project you're going to invest in that country. That country is making an application for funding for projects and programs, as it does already for other projects and programs, to bilateral and multilateral agencies. And that, in that respect, you're putting the onus on the country to ensure that it covers the all the dimensions that, that you mentioned, and to ensure that we are covering the full spectrum, because that process does demand that discipline. Does that answer your question? Yes? This looks like David Lang from Montreal. He's always full of awkward questions, this chap.
It is David Lang from Montreal, and I think Michael knew some of my concerns, and when my hand went up, he immediately looked at the other part of the room. I'd like to follow up a little bit on what our colleague said from Miami. I echo a lot of those concerns and problems, but I would suggest that no matter how noble this idea may be, it is foredoomed to failure if you try to sell it and defend it on economic return. You cannot apply the standard return on investment criteria that we international bankers would not only insist upon, but among ourselves have never been able to agree upon as to what constitutes an appropriate return on investment. For two reasons. First of all, it's impossible to define. Secondly, the return on investment implies not only a monetary figure, it also implies a certain time frame. And invariably, those time frames tend to go further than the next election or the next revolution, depending on which system you happen to be working under. I would suggest, therefore, that it is dangerous at best to think in terms of those kinds of justifications when you're doing your selling pitch to your potential funders. I would also caution my co-citizen from Calgary that surpluses tend to be very mercurial, and that the time frame for the successful completion of a lot of these projects would be a lot longer than the cycle between Japan being in a debtor position to being in a benefit position. And as far as going after some of the international banks concerned, especially the top nine and the one other, until recently on the balance sheet there were billions of dollars still listed as existing, which have now been written off, and so those surpluses have a bad habit of disappearing when the auditor finally gets his hands into the balance sheet. I suggest, therefore, that this be sold not through a democratic process. That would take too long and devour far too much of the funds to educate the cannon fodder, unfortunately, which populates the earth. We have to take almost an elitist program that we can see beyond our swollen bellies and look to the future in time frames and in results which are not easily understood or which can be, with intellectual honesty, be reduced down to some kind of simplistic definition. That being the case, I would hope that people and institutions would fund this on a longer term, on a multinational, not just on a national basis, that it would not be funded out of this year's surplus, which could be next year's deficit, and that it would become self-sustaining internally through, hopefully, a big enough initial capital base so that the income in local currencies from that capital base could be used without encroaching on capital. Those obviously are very high ideals, and maybe they're not realizable. But I fear that if you don't strive for that as your objective, all the good work, all the good wishes, and all the good money will very quickly come to nothing. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you, David. Just to comment on that, I think you raised some very good points there. I think this question of return and profit is clearly a crucial one. As we heard yesterday from Jane Pratt of the World Bank, this is an area which the World Bank is placing a great deal of attention and importance, and a lot of research is going into it. Jeremy Wolford at the World Bank is personally one of the pioneers on this. Bob Rapetta, who's in this room, is another one, and in fact he will be chairing a session tomorrow afternoon on this very subject. How do we reconcile the long-term environmental return with the shorter-term discounted cash flow needs of financial institutions today? And the answer is that there are ways to reconcile them, and there are techniques that are evolving, and we'll hear more about those tomorrow afternoon. But if you can combine in your co-financing multilateral finance, bilateral finance, debt swap finance, blocked currency finance, and private sector finance, and if on the other hand you can finance projects which which require those mixes of finance in order to develop those projects, i.e. there's some component of commercial content in that overall program, be it fishing, be it range farming, be it tourism, be it mining, be it forestry, whatever, chemical research, agroforestry. I mean, there are a whole range of income-generating projects which are associated with and have to be associated with conservation and sustainable development. And if I felt there was no way of reconciling what David has so eloquently put to us this afternoon, I don't think there'll be any case for a World Conservation Banking Program. You've got to find ways to reconcile the long-term cost of not doing many of the things that we want to do and the short-term needs of the balance sheet of the World Bank or anybody else. Now, there's a lady over here who I think was up there. Yes, please, would you? And there's a microphone down here. Sorry, all right.
Let me just try saying it and then you repeat.
Right. I didn't get your name.
Alice Egerson.
Alice Egerson.
From the
Forest History Society. Social justice versus national sovereignty, yes.
Right. And in your earlier remarks, you mentioned that many banks are now loath to lend to national governments. They want to lend to worthwhile projects, but not to governments.
Right.
What I'm wondering is what you thought about the problem of getting money to projects by going around governments, when in fact governments are the things that control access to the countries, the people, the projects. It seems to me that conservation funding often at the general level is discussed as if it was completely apolitical. And in fact, the blockages and the problems and the ineffective projects often turn out because there was insufficient understanding of or insufficient declaration of the political purpose at the beginning. And I wonder if you thought through that.
Well, you know, a lot of these issues are ones that we're going to have to confront in our feasibility study. These are complex issues. I was hoping that by using the National Conservation Strategy process as one example, I've seen some of the work done on these, and they try to combine the public and private sector in these projects that they're developing through the process. Well, in the case of Zambia, they are. In fact, some of the projects are very much have a very integral involvement of the local people, local communities, the creation of local co-ops, and so on. Very encouraging, I think. I think it's got a lot of good stuff if we can find the funds for it, and that's the challenge. And I believe if you get the expertise to pull these various components together and do the right financial analysis, you will find. I mean, in some cases, it may be a block currency that you can use. In other cases, it may be a debt swap to get some of the land. In other instances, it may be an international chemical company which will put some money into research for biological to sort of support the biological diversity aspect. And I think that we've got to develop some pilot projects like this. I mean, we have our friends here from Botswana. Nokabango Swamps is, for instance, a magnificent world resort. Many believe. Resort in the environmental sense and in the agricultural sense and so on. How can you, on the one hand, save a what is considered by many to be an area of world significance, on the other hand, feed Botswanians? And I think that there are, one could devise schemes whereby you've got to, if we want to save the Okavango swamps, we have to find a way to provide an incentive to the Botswanian government to save the Okavango swamps, for instance. Just to take an example, I don't want to sort of get too to personalize. If we're concerned about tropical forests and that people's livelihood is depends on those forests, cutting trees down, we've got to find a way to find an alternative if we want to save those forests. And that's part of the challenge of this conservation banking program. We're going to have to get into these areas, and we have a lot of work to do. And that's why it may take up to a year or two to do it.
But in the reforestation, in cutting down the forests, there are new methods now, which are really quite interesting, of how to afforest whole areas of the earth. And I think a great deal can be done by quite modern and new technological methods.
Right. You'd like to ask a question? Thank you. There's a microphone over there, if you like, which I think is, if it works.
I am Theodore Panayiotou from Harvard University, and I am concerned about the theoretical foundations of the concept, like people from such ivory towers are concerned with the theoretical issue. I think that we have to recognize some things, is that in order to promote a concept, it must have some kind of a power behind it, some engine which promotes it. I don't think it's sufficient to say that because we identify some potential sources of funding as sufficient for establishing a new institution. I think that the environmental movement has been working quite hard in recent years with the World Bank and with other institutions, development institutions, to get them to consider environmental issues, and they have been considering those, and that kind of work should continue. And I don't think there should be overlap of work, or in any way take the pressure off the World Bank from having to finance conservation projects which have an adequate economic rate of return. I think an institution like this, a World Conservation Bank, should concentrate and focus exclusively on those projects which either they are discarded by the bank because their economic return is not adequate or doubtful, or other conservation projects which are of great significance for the environment, such as great wilderness areas of unique value or conservation of certain species, which do not have an economic return which can be justified based on even broad cost-benefit analysis. I think that if such a conservation bank was to start financing projects which can be justified on economic basis, not only there would be overlapping and confusion with the bank, but I think something else. The World Bank has plenty of money to lend. The problem is more absorptive capacity in those countries, not that there is no resources. If a country comes up with a good economic project, a good conservation project with adequate return, the bank will finance it. Even the bank finance projects through IDA, which do not have adequate economic return, through concessionary lending. No? Okay, no. Okay. But what I propose is that to have a conservation bank which will do concessionary lending in the area of conservation. And the difference between whatever economic return these projects generate and the market rate of return on which funds become available from saving sources should be bridged by some kind of this bank through contributions by governments, mainly from developed countries, as well as by private sources. So what we need really is a subsidy for the difference between the economic return that these conservation projects could generate and the return which is necessary to justify the bank's existence and its sustainable development.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now that's
I'm going to talk about this, by the way, tomorrow in the proper PEDO session, so I don't want to preempt the subject.
This is coming up again tomorrow afternoon in this question of environmental return versus economic return. The intention is not to overlap or compete with the World Bank on projects where the World Bank could and does and will finance. I think it is a question of developing projects and programs which is difficult for the bank to finance for one reason or other. I absolutely agree. And I understand from friends of mine in the bank who I've been speaking to over the last two or three years that there are a number of those. And that would be certainly part of the portfolio that one would be looking at. Now, I don't want to go on too much longer because we do have another session coming up this afternoon, a very important one, a very good one. We've got some very good people on that. I'm going to ask the Maharaja of Baroda, please, to put a question to us. And then I think we're going to have to perhaps draw a sort of, and maybe one up there, two more from from Maharaja and from my friends in Botswana, and I think we're going to have to close it. And will you finish off? Right, you are. We have three more questions, then we're going to have to go into the next session. It's like a statement, not a question.
Don't like to turn my back on my friends. I'll be very brief. I've been listening patiently to Michael Sweetman's paper and discussion so far. I'm confused, particularly since I am the president of the World Wildlife Fund India, an NGO, of the need of another helping hand. But since this baby has been accidentally conceived by Michael Sweetman, and I presume that he's either a very foolish man or a very clever man. I think he's a very clever man, because the paper does not give any details. It's very general. And he probably wants to learn from us what to include. I give him that much credit. Some of the questions that I would like to ask are very brief. Is the intention to, if we go through with this, is it the intention to set up a corpus with a target to begin with and use only the interest thereof for the purposes of conservation?
Yes.
Is this the yes. idea?
Yes.
Two, a target has to be fixed to begin with. It can go on. Or let's say there's no target, but must be a basic target. Two, I feel that if a project is to be funded in a country, it should never be 100% funded. There must be a percentage of the funds that must be locally raised. Otherwise, you do not have local Agreed. Participation. And nobody appreciates a gift.
Agreed.
And unless you have local involvement and participation, your project will not bear as large a fruit as you desire. I come to my final question. If and when this fund is established, I presume it will, on its board or trustees or whatever it is, it will contain big financiers, directors, presidents of big banking corporations. But who is going to appraise the projects that come? Will there be a top class conservation committee to appraise any projects that come before this committee? Or is that financial committee going to decide on the merits of that project? That is all. Thank you.
Well, we're getting just what we want, some really good input from the audience. Thank you very much, Maharaja. I'll just react immediately first, then I'll pass it on to my colleagues. We're going to run over time here, but these are good questions, and we do have a bit of time. We have some time at the end to go over, so Jane and David and so on, we won't squeeze you out. On this question of sort of whether this is a fund or a bank, or whether it's a vehicle which acts as a catalyst, flow through, provides a service, the original concept was a conservation bank or fund. And it was a World Commission. In fact, Maurice Strong, who was one of the first people to suggest that it would be very ambitious to try and set up a fund or a bank in competition with other banks, perhaps, And that the first thing to do would be to illustrate that in fact a service was needed and could be developed, i.e. a program or a facility, which would work with the World Bank and aid agencies and block currencies and governments and the private sector, and would demonstrate over a period of time that it had an added value service that it could provide. And maybe as a second phase, having established credibility and expertise and some good people and so on, then it could think about escalating to a second phase whereby one would try to or hope to fund the institution internally as a bank or a fund or whatever. And that's the way it has progressed. And so we're looking at a modification of the original concept of a bank proper. We're looking at a banking program. There are, of course, people who feel that a banking program is not going to achieve what we want to achieve, that unless you have a fund or a bank. I mean, money means power, and without it, you have no power. And in fact, I will ask Mr. Rothschild in a second to comment on that, because we were discussing a particular proposal with some of the speakers in Denver and only yesterday. But I would like to think that once some credibility is established and once added value can be demonstrated, we should be looking for substantial funds being vested in this new institution so that it does have some ability to generate funds on an ongoing basis. Second point about countries being involved in funding some of the projects, I think that's extremely important, and I take that. It would certainly be my intention, I think, that one would hope to have as much local country involvement as possible. Possibly, and I know this wouldn't be at all popular with the country involved, if one got some kind of trade-off against, say, existing bilateral finance, but the quid pro quo would be additional bilateral finance. And I think that we're going to see more money coming down from the north to the south in one way or another over the next 5 or 10 years. We have to. And I'm presupposing there is going to be more money over a period of time in one way or another. And some of it will come through this channel. And the third point, I didn't write it down. What was the third point? Expertise, very much so. Without expertise, there wouldn't be any point to it. All right, thank you very much. Botswana? Say so? Yes, by all means.
Basically, I think the number of issues that this concept of seems to me to be fairly good conceptual. We have, however, problems that I think Mr. Lang referred to earlier on, which relates to this question of timing from Jeopardy. The main problem that we're dealing with is the fact that you've got, in many of these developing countries, a lot of people who are not able to sustain themselves. Consequently, they rely on their natural resources to do so. Now, if you are going to sustain natural resources, then it means that you're going to find people an alternative source of income. And that's really where the crux of the matter lies. That if you are going to find an alternative source of income, it means in simple terms you're going to find an alternative job to get them away from resources like capital and grazing and so on. And if this facility is going to be able to do that, then we are talking extremely long-term investment here. That is essential. The other thing which goes to the corollary of that is that people have to be taught to look after the natural resource base themselves. So you are talking long-term education. You are talking an investment which in fact is almost, you are unable to assess what kind of returns you are getting. And if we are in the long-term, then we hope to come up with anything, then it means that for generations you are going to have to teach a population increasing at 3.5% per annum, which means your problems are becoming increasingly difficult every year. So what I'm saying is that in the first instance we have to think in terms of investment which is very, very long term. Needless to say, there are quite a number of projects which can be dealt with in the short term and medium term. You've already mentioned some. One can think in terms, for example, of manpower development, where people have to be trained to do things themselves. One can think about the involvement of NGOs and so on. But I think you do have the very long-term issues which we have to which we have to consider. And here the whole question of national conservation strategy, as you mentioned, becomes very, very important. Because if you do not have an integrated plan to deal with all your natural resources problems, almost together, then of course what you're doing is you're going off in sectoral directions. And that does not help you because you'll be concentrating on one issue without dealing with the other. And the whole question, I think, of dealing with natural resources is to have an overall strategy that will make it possible for you, for example, to deal with issues of culture. Very important, how do people relate to certain things? And if you are going to change that sort of cultural background, if it's necessary, if it's found to be necessary to change the way that people use their natural resources, then in fact what you're saying is that you've got to educate and re-educate whole generations of people. You've got to deal with the old, you've got to deal with the present generation, and you've got to deal with the future generation. So that you are talking about paradoxical things. And therefore I think these are some of the things that we've got to think of. But I think the concept itself is a very good one, that we do have to get some alternative sources of finance to deal with some of these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's another excellent contribution, and I hope you're going to be one of my pilot projects for the feasibility study, because I can see that it would be a very extremely productive one. No question, this is long term. No question that people have to be involved. It reminds me of a story of not a story. It reminds me of an incident of a game reserve that I know of in Africa, which has been preserved for. As a game reserve, surrounded by peoples who were grazing their cattle on land with very little grass left. And for years and years and years, there's people been looking in at the lush green grass on the inside of that fence. They are allowed to gather wood, to cut grass, to eat. They obtain fresh meat from that reserve. They obtained that from that reserve 20 years ago, they obtained those facilities from that reserve 10 years ago, they obtained them today, and hopefully they will continue to enjoy the benefits of that reserve. Had those people been allowed to cross the fence, as they often tried to in the past, that reserve wouldn't be there today. And I think there have to be some trade-offs. There have to be some trade-offs, short-term versus long-term. If we only are concerned with jobs and bellies today and disregard the long term, and if that means destruction of habitat, well, there's sometimes going to have to be some tough decisions. We're going to have to say we can't afford to destroy the habitat. We're going to have to move those people or give them other jobs, or as I said before, we've got to find incentives for them, whatever they may be. Maybe it's hunting, tourism, maybe it's other forms of investment. The monarch butterfly instance is a very good example of that in Mexico. So yes, thank you very much for your comments. I think that's a very valid contribution, and look forward to further dialogue with you on this important subject. Last question coming up, please.
My name is Sylvia Eagle, and I have...
Talking to the microphone.
My name is Sylvia Eagle, and I have a great many questions, but because we are running late, I'm just going to make a comment. It's something that bothered me over the 2.5 days in Denver, and it bothered me again this morning in your address, Dr. Strong. The two people that I wrote down comments of was yours this morning and Mr. Ruckelshaus. Mr. Ruckelshaus said, in recent months, we have seen attention paid to environmental pollution because people have become sufficiently prosperous to afford to be able to pay attention to the environment. And lots of people said in different ways, and you said this morning, poverty is the single greatest cause of environmental degradation. Well, I want to say that I really believe, if you look at it, that poverty is not the single greatest cause of environmental degradation, and that we are going to be starting off from the wrong base if we have this as the base for our thinking. If poverty were the single greatest cause for environmental degradation, you wouldn't have such degraded lands in the United States. You wouldn't have the degraded lands that we have in the rest of Europe. You wouldn't have the acid rain damaging the forests. You wouldn't have spills into the Irish Channel from our nuclear power plants in Britain. You wouldn't have all the terrible things that are happening. And we, you know, are among the richest nations. And poverty is an effect. It is not a cause.
Let me respond with all vigor. I don't know if you've ever been to the developing world. You perhaps have. But anyone who has seen and experienced the poverty of the developing world surely would have to realize that the vicious circle by which people striving simply to exist have got to destroy the natural resource base on which they depend for their livelihoods simply to survive today. That is not to say that what you said in the latter part of your remarks are not correct. It is entirely true that many of the world's largest environmental problems, and particularly those experienced most directly by those of us who live in the industrialized world, we are the minority, do come from the very processes of industrialization and urbanization which have been the source of our wealth, which means that much of our wealth has been based upon our, as we perceive it now, our misuse of our natural resource base. It is certainly the economic drives of the rich and the mismanagement of the rich has contributed tremendously, and in fact to the global problems that we're talking about. Global climate change comes from the very significant component of that is from the burning of fossil fuels, which is primarily arises in the rich world. Ozone depletion. Some of those larger issues do in fact come, acidification, from the very processes which have made the rich rich. That is true, but it is still true that the real issue that we must face, the rich are now getting to the point where they understand their problems. They haven't got all virtue yet, but there is a capacity in the industrialized world to address these issues. There is an increasing will to do so. We've got a long way to go in the industrialized world, but it's still true that as we look ahead, that the 4 out of 5 people who will be living in the developing world, it's almost that now, by the end of this century, and their imperative for economic growth, their imperative to eliminate the poverty that is, for the first time in history, it has been feasible to do. In my view, I stand by that view, that is still the single biggest issue that confronts our planet. The single biggest source of degradation of the resource base of our planet comes from the vicious circle of poverty that has to be broken. And if it is not broken, there is very little chance that the majority of people who live in the third world will be able to achieve their aspirations for a better life, or that any of us on this planet will be able to achieve the degree of environmental security that we're all working for.
The Maharaja of Baroda raised some very important questions, and I think they've been answered in that the feasibility report which has been prepared is one that is now ready to go forward. I think the gentleman from Botswana was quite right in what he said about the education of people. People like Geldof, who can raise huge sums of money for the relief of famine in Ethiopia and the Sudan, those are the sort of people to be harnessed for the younger generation. But perhaps this conference might like to think more about the Marshall Plan, which had been mooted and put forward very tentatively at the Denver conference. And perhaps this might be the keynote of what you have heard today and what perhaps you might like in some perhaps amended form to have put forward. At this conference, recognizing the needs to protect our ecological and environmental heritage within the concept of the World Wilderness Congress, World Wildlife Fund, and all other bodies involved in the preservation of life on our planet, ask the Prime Minister of Norway, Right Honourable the Gro Harlem Brundtland, as one of the world's leaders of a greatly respected community, to be the promoter of this international conservation bank. By her Brundtland report, which has been widely circulated to world leaders, she could follow up this report with the recommendations to promote a second Marshall Plan, the third world debt relief, and finance for a stable development.
Right.